This is the Strategy Inside Everything. I'm Adam Pierno. The Strategy Inside Everything is the podcast for people who think for a living. If this conversation gives you an idea, leads to a question, or makes you want to push back on something you hear, go to thatsnotaninsight.com, where you can leave a message or send me a voicemail. The best and most interesting will be added to the future episodes, and I can't wait to hear from you. All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Strategy Inside Everything. It is my absolute pleasure to have one of our very few repeat guests on, Katie Drakey. She's the founder of Drakey Consultancy, helping agencies, companies, people think about their offerings in a more meaningful way, I would say. Katie, how you doing?
Yeah, good. Yeah, thanks for inviting me back.
Are you kidding me? I frequently get comments, you know, about the episodes, but your episode in particular, where I think when we met and when where you were thinking about your own path and your career, that has stuck with me. So when I had the chance to talk to you again, I was like, yes, let's do it. Yeah. Would you give people, if they are new listeners, which there are many, would you give them a kind of a quick rundown? They can go back and I'll tag the old episode with the advance. But I think your background is important for the conversation we're about to have.
Yeah. I'm originally from Seattle, a Pacific Northwest local. I've got, 25, almost 30 years now of agency background. But I've also worked client side in a couple different instances. I worked at Adidas in Europe. And also 7 years at Nike here in Portland, Oregon. I've also had the great joy of moving around the world quite a bit. I spent 4 years in the Netherlands, a little over 2 years in Sydney, Australia, and I got a chance to work across some clients in like Southeast Asia and do a lot of research there. And then also spent time working with Nike in Tokyo, Japan, which was a wicked highlight of my career, I'd have to say. Now I'm running my own consultancy. I'm based in Portland, Oregon. But by the silver lining of the pandemic, I've managed to do all this, you know, through the computer screen largely due to the timing of everything. And I've had clients all around the world. I've worked with Oatly and Klarna of Sweden, and I have larger clients like Google and Nike, but I've also worked with some startups. And I've started getting into doing some advisory and coaching as well. I met with a startup founder yesterday, who I'll be working on a coaching assignment for about 3 months.
Nice.
It's been a very wide swath of interactions. Some very strategic, most pretty strategic, but a couple of my assignments have been really fun in that they've been the opposite end of the spectrum and very consumer facing. One of the things I'm most excited about this fall is I got a chance to work on the 60th anniversary marketing campaign for Steamboat Springs Ski Resort. A chance to actually go ski with the team and work for 2 days and have a workshop with the new marketing lead. And we made like a classic advertising campaign is going to be coming out this fall with
Cowboy. Remember those?
And I know. And I also got to reconnect to an amazing creative, Richard Bullock, and some other folks that I worked with at 180 Amsterdam, which feels like a million years ago now, but it was a nice full circle and like one of my few sort of consumer facing assignments this year. So I got a chance to do really just about everything. It's been great.
Your background and the diversity of the organizations and companies, agencies, and that you've worked with in your past and that you still engage with now is part of why you're the exact perfect person to talk about this topic with today. You and I have been going back and forth on what are the conditions for good work? You know, what has to happen in an office or on a Zoom with 20 screens for, and I don't think we should talk about whether that matters or not, but what are those conditions that you have seen, that I have seen, that tend to generate more either prolific or just higher quality thinking, higher quality work, and you know, what of that is repeatable and what of that is sort of accidental good luck.
Yeah.
In some cases.
Yeah. I mean, when I've thought back on the times that I have been a part of a team where I felt like the mojo was happening, so much of that almost feels intangible and really hard to make happen.
Yeah.
But I do feel like there are some things you can do to create fertile territory for the mojo to flow, if you will. And one of those things I think is this dichotomy of chemistry that's really working, but also friction. And I think the tension of chemistry and friction being, you know, personalities, people are little chemistry sets themselves full of chemicals and adrenaline and serotonin.
Electrical impulses.
Some of them are restrained. Some of them have no filter. Like, there's a lot of chemistry.
And some of them swing back and forth across those.
Yeah. In a meeting. Yeah. but there can also be really positive or negative or difficult or easy chemistry with a client or even with a brief.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes a brief will land and everybody's like, oh my God, this is going to be good. You know, this is going to be great. Or people are like, shit, what are we going to do with this thing? Like, right. It kind of lands on the table with a thump and you're like, oh man. So chemistry, when I think it's really working, it's like bubbling 80% of the way. And then there's maybe a little bit that's kind of a little tough. And that kind of leads into the friction part. Like, not every member of the team should be BFFs. You know, somebody does need to be a time cop. Somebody does need to be pragmatic. Somebody does need to dream. And there's friction there that's naturally introduced into the system.
And chemistry where the push for, you know, if we're talking about a traditional or untraditional, like an ad agency model, it doesn't matter, that there is a role for someone who is pushing the creative and trying to make it amazing and let's make it a mini film and let's do this thing that is not pragmatic at all. That needs to happen. Mm-hmm. And the person who says, right, that's cool. But remember, before we build a TikTok account, the assignment is for this single page print ad. Like, yes, I'll put that at slide 3, but slide 1, we got to cover this thing, you know, and both of those need to be in the room. Otherwise you end up with check boxes.
Yeah. And you know, I think I love working with production people because that's where the rubber hits the road.
Yeah, they know how.
Can we actually make that? How do we actually make that? What sorts of feats of strength do we need to engage in to like make this thing that we all really believe in? And I've worked with producers who are dreamers as well, and they will go to the ends of the earth and they will turn themselves inside out to try to figure out how to make something happen, and they will invent new methods or find other geniuses to create with. And those are the producers I want to work with. But there's also producers who kind of get a bad rap as being like the person who says no to everything. No, we can't do that. No, that's too expensive. No, we don't have enough time. And, you know, to be fair, that's part of their job to be real.
And
to
sometimes be realistic. The answer is no.
And sometimes the answer is no. But I don't like when people's first reaction is no. And that's usually a signal to me that I'm working with someone who's just not going to be able to create the level, the highest bar that we all want to really put into the world. We've got a naysayer on our hands. Uh-oh. You know, like we actually needed a crazy scientist, you know, who's like, yes, I want to put this out in the world and I will do anything in my power to make it happen.
Yeah, that's true of producers, but also true of developers or technologists as well.
Yeah.
In the early internet days, I remember being frustrated as a creative because they would say, I would say, we have this idea. I don't know how it works because I don't understand the back end, but it should do this. The person does, the user does this, and this is what happens. They would go, that's not possible. That's not technically, you can't do it. And they'd be like, all right, send in someone else because I need someone else to say, oh, you can't do exactly that, but let me go read this website. I think I can do this thing that's close, or let me call this person.
Or we could invent it.
Yeah.
It's never been done before, so we're going to do it for realsies. Yes, there's like time and cost implications to that, but if we actually want to do it, we can. This is how it gets done, and here's the compromises you have to make. And so I like it when producers, as much as they're able, say yes first.
Yeah.
And show what the trade-offs are.
That's what they need to know.
Yeah.
And that's an important element. Yeah. I didn't qualify what is good work. But I think good work meets the assignment, but also exceeds the expectations of what's possible. And that of someone being able to say, okay, here's some trade-offs. Like, oh, it will look cooler this way, but be a little less functional. And this will deliver more impact from a ROI standpoint, but it'll not look as good.
I agree with you that there's good creative, which is you answer the brief and the work performs. That's really good. And then great is you deliver on the assignment, the work performs, you're pushing the industry and the medium into a new space that makes it really difficult for others to follow. That means for other brands to replicate it, but also for other agencies and creatives to replicate it, because you have mutated it in some way that you've created distinction that can't be replicated.
Yeah, I used to think about it as work that makes the competitors jealous.
Yeah, yeah. I used to say, oh my God, that's so good, I want to spit.
Yours is much more passionate than mine. I like yours better.
I had a friend at an agency, we'd be like, oh, yeah. So good. I'm so mad right now.
The energy of a brief hitting the table. And there is a time when you've cracked a brief and you know it and you share it with the team and they're reading it and you could see their eyes moving and you could see them, like the physical response. You can sense like, oh, they're plugged into this thing. They get it. And then there's times where it's just like, ugh, you know, maybe I didn't deliver or I thought I did, but what in your mind makes that leap in a brief from the, yeah, okay, you filled it out, but it's not transcendent. It's not generating the emotional response you want, or that they don't understand enough to get excited about it.
Yeah. I can remember times in which I have delivered like a clanger of a brief and like it did not go well. And in my juniorness at the time, I'm thinking of a couple specific examples. I didn't have the seniority and the experience level to understand whether it was the brief is really just meh, or these people who've come into this room are bringing their garbage with them. And because, as you know, anything is interesting to someone who's interested. And it is also the responsibility and the job of creative teams receiving briefs to become interested in everything that's being placed in front of them.
Right.
Sometimes you're just not getting the partnership from the creative team. They're like, oh, I don't want to do this credit card thing. You know, I don't believe in credit cards, or whatever the attitude is that they bring in. Maybe it's just like a, you know, combative sort of mood. And so things can clang because of that. Yeah. I think in my early days, I always thought it was my fault at the brief, you know, was a thud on the table.
I still do.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes I leave the room going, oh yeah, I can see all the flaws now in what I wrote, and I can see all the opportunities I missed. I'd love another go. You know, and sometimes you get another chance because there'll be a first creative review, the work will come back, and you have an opportunity to sort of modify the brief a little bit to still keep it on on the path, but add a little more context to give a little more creative elbow room. But a lot of that, you know, comes back to that first point about chemistry and friction, you know, like needing the right chemistry with the ECD so that you can talk about these things on the back channel and kind of set up the creative teams for success. But yeah, I've also had amazing briefings, but in a lot of those times, some of it is just the context of the brief. Like it's just a sweet situation.
Yeah. I mean, some projects are better than others, and we can, everybody listen.
But I've also learned, even if you don't get a chance to leave the building on the day of the briefing and like go and have a full bodied experience that connects the team kinetically and emotionally to the work, which is usually the best case scenario. Like if you're selling lawnmowers, like go out and mow a lawn and like have a glass of lemonade and go through the brief. Like there's things you can do that are like really solidify the idea in people's minds, puts them into the literal footprints of the consumer. Also, some creatives are really excited by the business aspects. You know, we're trying to turn the business from here to here, or here's a kind of outcome that we want to see to the P&L. Some of them don't give a shit about it. So it's sometimes it's just a little bit about knowing your internal audience as well, knowing your creative team and knowing how to wind them up.
Yeah.
Like, goes back to that chemistry thing.
And those specific people.
Some creatives need to be challenged. No one's ever done this before. I don't know. Can you guys do this? This is a really hard brief. I don't know. You know, like kind of you see doubt and then they get excited by that. Others are like, I just need to understand the emotion. You know, you need to make it very emotional, make it this sort of like empathetic mind meld with the consumer. And then they go away inside the mind. You can see them kind of walking out of the room with kind of glassy eyes. They're just occupying the consumer as they're leaving the room and they're going in to do their brainstorming at the coffee shop or wherever.
And it's, yeah. When you say chemistry and tension, the way you were describing it at the outset, I thought right away of walking into a bar and they give off an energy. Like you can walk into somewhere you've never been, you go to a new city, you walk in and right away you say, oh, I want to get out of this. Like, I don't feel safe here.
Yeah.
Or this isn't my thing. I don't want to be here. Yeah. Or, yeah. Oh, I'm going to be here all night. Like I am not, I'm going to find a stool and I'm not moving around. The energy is so good. And it's not all because chemistry is positive and everybody's the same. There's some tension in there of like, oh, look, it's like, there's different types of people or there's different conversations where there's a game on over there and there's a jukebox over here. And as people are pulling different parts of the energy to create something unique in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you're kind of hitting on the other thing that makes it possible for these other team players to play their role. Cause what we're doing is theater essentially. And so you need like all the players, the creative players, the time cop players, the, you know, dollars and cents players and production realists, is you need that level of safety and you need that level of belonging. Like a producer isn't going to feel safe saying yes, but if they know they're going to get clobbered, if it doesn't work out, or if they have to change what they said, if they're in a defensive position, they're like, no, we can't do that. Cause I don't feel safe sticking my neck out in any degree here, because I need to tell you what the safe answer is, what we definitely can do in the time and, you know, capacity that we have. I don't feel at all comfortable making a risk. So I think some of that is around belonging, a sense of belonging that teams need to feel with each other, that regardless of whether we're BFFs or not, I want you here. Because I recognize that you're talented and you're talented in a way that's different from the way that I'm talented. And you belong here. You have a role to play and I want you in the room.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, and I've been on teams like that where I don't feel like people want me in the room. Sometimes it's because I'm the planner and they think I'm a wasted body, you know, or I'm new and they don't trust that I know the work as well as they do, or whatever the case may be, you can feel that vibe. And so there isn't the level of safety to really stretch from good to great. And as you know, like there's been a lot of conversation the last couple of years about some of the problems in the agency world or in the creative space or in the tech space, and that not everyone has been held to the same level of accountability and not everybody has been given the same accessibility to the opportunities. And all I'm here to say is like more safety means more creativity. You know, if we can kind of kibosh some of those things and neutralize some of those negatives, I think the creative output is really what wins. And when the creative wins, I mean, like that's where the Holy Spirit is in the world of agency. Like everyone wants to deliver the best creative and they want to wow their peers and they want to push the mediums and the industry forward.
Yeah.
So I think safety is really one of the critical conditions.
Do you, when I was in my dealings with agencies, like when I was in agencies, I think I was more worried about being embarrassed by saying a bad idea, but in corporate environments, either in front of clients or in-house, I am more afraid of being like told I'm wrong. You know, it's they're different types of fear, but both of them are bad.
Yeah.
Both of them limit you from saying like, what about this crazy idea?
Yeah. And I should also clarify, like safety can mean different things to different people. I don't mean creative safety. Like we should all be taking risks there and we should be pushing ourselves out to the end of the ledge. But what I do mean is like what you just described, like social safety. I'm not going to be humiliated. Emotional safety, that I feel this is a place that lifts me as opposed to tears me down, or places undue tensions, you know,
unnecessary. Be honest with me.
Yeah. There's not a lot of smoke and mirrors. Like we're on the same team and we're marching to the same drum and we're going to the same destination and we are going to take risks together, creative risks together. We're going to actually take off our seatbelt creatively. And we're going to, but that puts so much more responsibility on the emotional, psychological side and the social side, because that allows the creativity to really unleash itself and to be unsafe as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never had that conversation. Have you in your work? Have you talked to people about that? I've never, that's never come up for me. Now I'm like, ugh, I must've been the worst.
I have never been in like an agency setting in which that has been spoken about openly and frankly in those sort of like terms. It does feel like a new phenomenon in the last maybe 5 or 10 years that we even have the language to talk about this in the work environment.
That's fair.
Especially during quarantining times and pandemic times, we've all been talking more about like work wellness and taking care of ourselves during this, you know, unprecedented moment.
More than ever.
More than ever. but there, I do remember going through some corporate training at Nike in which they were trying, it was very new, but they were trying to get teams to be very vulnerable together. And I'll just say the first one that I went through, they really wanted us to be vulnerable. I did not feel safe being vulnerable.
Yeah.
I did. I really wanted to connect to my teammates in a sort of like stripped back, see me for who I am. But I also felt myself hedging. You know, I wasn't actually being 100% unveiled. I didn't feel safe enough.
I started sweating in 3 seconds of those kind of icebreakers.
I was exhausted at the end of that day. It was nerve wracking. And yeah,
that's really hard for me to do as well.
And so it left me wondering, like, is that really honest to ask people to do this in a high pressure corporate environment, to strip back? Is that even fair or honest to ask people to do that? Will people ever really reach that level? Because you know, you're going into a performance review with these same human beings a few months later, you know, it's a high stakes. It feels like a high stakes situation. And yet we do need to do some level of that. And so maybe it's about just finding the right modulation.
I don't like it going through it as an employee, but I would rather have organizations try it than not try it. Like, I think it's important that we get the opportunity to do it and connect. And if it's in a different format, and I hate every minute of it when I'm doing it, but what's the option?
And I think maybe the discomfort is kind of part of it. Mm-hmm. You're meant to feel the discomfort, be aware of it, and learn from what you see in yourself.
We're all embarrassed together.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all feeling uncomfortable in this room together, but also it's like, what about it is making you uncomfortable? And also, do you need to feel uncomfortable? Maybe it's a little bit self-imposed, you know? So, safety is an interesting thing around the creative and excellent work space, because to be most excellent and to push the bar forward, you have to take your seatbelt off and make yourself unsafe, which puts more requirements on the other types of safety, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. What are some of the conditions for that safety? I mean, what is it that makes like in those environments where you were just like, oh, I can just be myself.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about what made that work? What was the ingredient in the soup that made it feel okay?
Yeah. I mean, for me, there's a couple dynamics at play. One is the classic, you know, work environment top down. You do need sort of permission. I have been on teams in which we didn't have quote unquote permission from senior leadership to work the way we were working. We just kind of decided we were going to work this way. And then we put on our game face when we go into reviews and, you know, senior leadership that has no idea that we're operating in a different way.
Right.
But that is silly because it almost feels, I mean, it creates like a collegiality, which is also really awesome, but it's also kind of a farce. Right. But I think it's more powerful when from top down, you're given like the agency to solve the problem in the way that you think is best.
Right.
And the encouragement to go as deep and as interpersonal into the work as you possibly can or feels right to do on any given brief. And then the other bit I think is some simple things like humor. When you're in a really formal environment and you can't just crack a silly joke or make a silly voice or take some of the tension out of the work, it doesn't feel safe. Like it doesn't feel real because, you know, the real world is messy and it's silly and humans are weird. And so you kind of have to have some humor. And so some of the best projects I've worked on, we've made up our own little catchphrases. Maybe there was even like silly artifacts that came out of it, like a mascot or like a t-shirt or, I'm still in touch with people where we sometimes will send each other little text messages with these.
I'm on a text chain too, where those like stupid things, the shared.
Yes.
Is like a thing that I can share with five people and they all give me the thumbs up or the heart back, really quickly.
And I think that there's something about, humor that makes things feel very textured and real, and it takes tension out of a tension. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of these briefs are time bound. Mm-hmm. There's moments where you're being reviewed and critiqued. We get accustomed to that tension and it no longer, causes a lot of stress, but the tension is there for a purpose, and sometimes you got to break it. So I think just humor and
levity
and bringing some levity.
You mentioned time. Talk a little bit more about how you think about time. There's more than one version of how time is experienced.
Yeah. I like to dork out on time quite a lot. And I think for a great, not a good, but a great creative output, there's ways in which you can leverage the mechanics of time to give yourself a better chance of showing up in the world in a distinctive way. One of those ways is to stretch time. And I usually just use the phrase, look back to look forward. And there's a ton of history that we can see and dive into to understand human beings. We're not that different from human beings that just showed up, or didn't just show up, that evolved and had civilizations and struggles and needs. And you can see through history, like these really interesting markers of just what is true about people. And what are some of the examples? Like I'm working on a beer brand once. I looked back and was like, when did fermentation start? When did people start doing this? It's like thousands of years. You can look back in the desert and there's like these evidence of like these beer gardens and festival places where there's no water, there's no city, there's a structure, and you can see that they were brewing in this location and that thousands of people would come. And you're like, oh, dang, this is like Coachella from like 4,000 years ago. There's wonderful things that you can see to reinforce what we already kind of feel. And it feels good. It's grounding. And then you kind of use that to stretch into the future and to think about, well, what sort of macro things or technology things, if we spin them out to like the next 100 years, or I'm a card-carrying member of the Long Now Foundation, which decides to look back 10,000 years, which is kind of the time box of civilization, and then try to look forward 10,000 years, which is an insane amount of time. But you listen to their podcast series and you start to really see the world through a very elastic view of time, geological time. And so I like to bring stretchiness of time into creative exercises. We know this is like a campaign that's going to run over holiday 2023 or whatever.
Right. Some people are just trying to get through 8 hours, right?
I know. I was like, but for the moment, allow ourselves to kind of play with time as a construct. The other thing I've just kind of stumbled upon recently is this idea of Chronos and Kairos. And it's this kind of old Greek way of looking at time by saying there's two types of time. And Chronos time is like the clock. It's, you know, 60 minutes is an hour, and then another 60 minutes is another hour, and you know, 24 hours is a day, and then another 24 hours is another day, and they're units of time, and they're structured, and they're static.
They're predictable.
And they can build, and they're predictable. And, but then there's this other construct of time called Kairos, which means in any moment, that moment can feel like, you know, a day, it can feel like an hour, you can lose track of time. I remember one time I got a new video game and my husband had taken the kids camping. So I was in the house by myself and I was like, I'm just going to get into this game and check it out. I started playing around like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and suddenly realized, oh, my stomach hurts. I wonder if I'm getting sick. And then I realized it was 1 o'clock in the morning and I played through dinner. I was in Kairos. By the way, like my time had totally lost all meaning. Oh,
I've done that with books or streaming a show where all of a sudden you're on season 3 and you know, you're like, wait a minute, did I just watch 18 of these in a row?
Oh my God. Yeah. What has happened? And sometimes like a really good brainstorm can feel that way. You get in there and, you know, ideas are building on each other and the flow is happening and we can feel that we're not getting to a destination. We're not getting sharper, but we're getting clearer with every hour or every minute. And then the time starts to fall away and you're not thinking about time anymore. You're thinking about the builds. Oh, that build was really good. Let's keep going. Maybe we can, oh, look, we got another build. Right. Oh, yeah. You know, let's turn the idea this way. Oh, now we can see this other facet. Oh, wow. Is somebody hungry? Let's order pizza. You know, let's stay here. And then before you know it, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, shit, that was really great. We lost track of the structured time. And so I think like really great creativity needs both. You know, you do need to get there on time.
Yeah.
You need to deliver in time for what the client is paying you to do and is planning to like fuel with a whole bunch of media and get a bunch of eyeballs on it and interactions. But the Kairos time is really important for the creative to marinate and develop.
Have you been able to figure out what creates that? Like, I think we have all worked at places that you want to be there until 3 a.m. and places where it's like the theater of being there till late because that's the culture and we are here. We don't stop working, but nobody's really working. They're all just standing around and hoping the boss sees
them. They're struggling
for bed checks. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you go into that realm wanting it to be Kairos, but it doesn't happen. You know, like there's a struggle bus that you're on and you do feel like you need to give it the Kairos time, but nothing like the magic isn't happening.
It doesn't click. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of that is due to the earlier points we made around chemistry and safety and, some of it, you know, some of it is just like the muse doesn't always come to the party, even though she's been invited. So, And if you have chemistry and safety, sometimes what you can realize is, you know what, the struggle bus has gone on long enough.
Yeah, it's not happening.
We're gonna call it. It's not happening today. We're going to try again tomorrow. You know, I think there are things that you can do that may, you know, beyond chemistry and safety that invite the muse in, and she might have a better chance showing up. And some of that is, and it also depends a little bit on the creative teams what they thrive in. But I've found like some protection, like some cocooning, either like giving them a physical space, either in the building that where no one can find them, or giving them license to go off building, like a couple times. I've rented a penthouse hotel room for a creative team, and I'm like, go use the gym, have a swim, order room service, and spend a full 24 hours in this beautiful place. It's not our office. It's not where you live.
Yeah, go
do it. Starbucks. Like, and it also feels like you're doing important work and we're making you comfortable. And so you choose like a vibe of a particular hotel or building or whatever. Or like, if I have a friend who I know is working at a different company, can my team come and sit somewhere on your floor today and just hide them. You know, so sometimes it's a cocoon.
Mm-hmm. The physical space of having separation.
Sometimes you give them something to do. And like, hey, I need you guys to go to this theme park and ride roller coasters all day long and just talk with each other. Or, hey, I need you to go to this cooking class because, you know, maybe it's a food related brief or something. I want you to get your hands into the work and go and like, don't brainstorm. Like you kind of tell them you're not supposed to think about the work, but we know it will happen.
Somewhere back there. You're right. It is happening.
Somewhere along the way, they'll be like, you know, well, we were making noodles last night. Or, you know, two hours ago, you're not having a beer at the end of the day. And you're like, I had this idea while we were doing that class. And so sometimes it's, like cocooning the work and giving it the protection it needs. And sometimes it's about giving the creatives distance from the work so that the work enters when it's.
And so it's not like, oh, get the creative people away from the email and the account people that are bothering them. It's more get them in a place where they're separated from the work altogether so their mind can wander.
Yeah. Because it's hard. You know, you might even take their phones. Give them a walkie-talkie and just be like, beat me when you need the Uber to come. You know, we'll send a car for you and then you can, you know, come into work the next day and we can start, you know, but by that point, though, their brains will have been scrubbed, their palate cleansed. They'll come in the morning like, oh my God, I had all these ideas while I was riding roller coasters because nobody asked them to. It's creative people are naturally creative. And so sometimes you just need to get all the other stuff off of them.
Yeah, the double-edged sword of deadlines. You know, the deadline always makes something is delivered, but it's the freedom, that elastic part of time that makes an idea pop into your mind.
And as a strategist, I see my role as being this sort of entity that flutters around the perimeter. And if I see a struggle bus happening, I won't necessarily tell the team I'm doing this, but I'll work on some additional architectures in the background. Cause it's like, well, if they're getting a lot of ideas, but the ideas aren't clicking or they don't know what to do with them, at the next meeting, I could just pull out of my back pocket a bucketing system so we can start to organize the thinking. And it won't be about force ranking it. It won't be about critiquing it. It's just about like, of mind mapping it a little bit, kind of creating bundles, because sometimes when you reorganize the work, that's what clicks something for them. You're like, oh, I didn't even think about it in that. Now I want to go over here. Now I know where I want to go.
Right.
So I try to think about what are the different tools and structures without boxing anybody into a cul-de-sac, without making anybody feel judged or measured or critiqued, but just that I'm this extra appendage that can be, you know, applied to the hand, you know, and to help the grasp happen a little bit better or more.
You're like a second thumb.
I'm another thumb. Yeah. Put a ring on me, a cool thumb ring, and I'll come to the party and try to help the creatives imagine what their imaginings in different landscapes. And, and then of course, once time starts, you know, Chronos time starts moving and we're getting closer and closer to moments where we need to show up in front of the client. I do that translation, you know, or most strategists do, you know, do that translation of dream space and idea space into action space and projecting outcomes.
Yeah. And either through your own insights or through the secondary insights that you're like, this is how we lead this. This is how we explain this story.
And when it really works, it's so satisfying. I think, I witness it in the faces of my creative partners, and I also feel it inside myself that I have given them, if I do my job really well, I have given them the license to continue to dream. Uh-huh. I've taken all the tension they might feel out of responsibility for the P&L.
Yeah.
And I've taken it on my shoulders and I've connected their beautiful dream to, you know, the impact and the performance that needs to happen. And so now they're free. They're free to go into how do we make this the most beautiful thing I've ever seen before? And how do I work with my producer to invent and design, you know, the impossible? Yeah. Because now we've been given license to do so because the creative idea has been made legitimized in some way.
That's it.
And it's legitimization, not because it wasn't a great idea or we didn't believe in it or something. It's that the client who's buying it has to see it for their performance review.
Exactly.
And the legitimization of them spending their budget on our work. Yeah. And so as much as we need to create emotion and, excitement and inspiration, without that tether to true, they will always doubt. They will always be, they'll question. And when a creative feels doubted or questioned, this armor, you can kind of see the calluses come up on the skin, and they're not in their safe place. Right. So it is a kind of a way of actually providing safety to the creative idea itself, and
proving to them you're going to support the idea, and
I'm going to support it. I'm going to legitimize the hell out of it.
Yep.
That client is going to love this. You go be amazing. Yeah. And I've now created a moat, so that you don't need to feel in danger.
Katie.
That kind of gets me to the last thing I wanted to add there. It's like,
you're blowing my mind. Go ahead.
Ideas need moats. The last thing I'll add is also the classic thing that I think strategy people often care about the most, and that's probably their role on the team, is around perspective.
Yeah.
And
context.
Trying to be the empaths of the team to, yes, understand the client and the business needs, of course, but really, what is happening in culture? Why is it happening this way? Why are these weird people doing these bewildering things? And where's the emotional center that we can tap into in our audience? Is it about their age? They're old or they're young, and they feel a fear or a weakness there? Or is it that they're a high earner and there's some sort of like a confidence, but maybe it's a false confidence? Or they're an underserved member of society because of their gender or because of their color or because of their immigration status? And what can we understand about that? Like really, really understand about that, so that when our messages land, whether it's a PSA or it's a Super Bowl ad, it's getting right in there very quickly, right, and very poignantly. And we've all seen ads that, especially during the Super Bowl, I'll say, the music comes on, there's some slow motion video.
Yeah, but it's
you don't know in the first 5 or 10 minutes. Anybody could be saying this, a butter brand, a beer brand, a bank,
right,
like anybody could be doing this sort of like, an unprecedented time. So we saw a lot of that in the last couple.
Of course. Years,
right.
And it's hollow.
And it feels, it feels false. I'm just making a little film here, but I think if you really get under the skin of stuff, you probably won't turn it into a Super Bowl ad. You'll turn it into some sort of impact program where you're doing something real in the community.
Yes.
And then maybe you'll tell some people about it to make sure that they know that they can contribute and they can feel proud of you as a brand, as a customer of your brand, and that there's ways for them to get involved. And that just kind of goes more into the, when you have really good perspective, what do you do with it?
Right.
And that leads you more into like, well, what does modern marketing look like? And a lot of it is, less static, vacuous storytelling and more rolling up your sleeves and getting some sweat equity into the game.
Yeah. Less ads.
Yeah.
Less often.
Yeah. Cause one of the perspectives is audiences see through all that veneer. Now it's not Mad Men anymore. We are playing a very different storytelling game in this
Absolutely.
World. Yeah.
So even what does work look like? What does good work look like? What even is the work?
It's totally
different than it was, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Katie Drakey, thank you so much for making time for me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for inviting me to come talk about fun stuff. Like I get excited about this too. And
I think new show idea. I just talk to you every week and we just publish that. I wish you could make time for that.
Well, you can call me again and I will always pick up. Yeah.
Listen, that's happening. Yeah. You're going to be my first three-time guest for sure.
Awesome.
Where can people find you online, Katie?
I'm on all the things. It's usually first name, last name. So like Twitter's at Katie Drakey. I have a little web page, not even a website, a web page, which I am going to try to, now I'm going to say it in public. So I have to do it. I'm going to up-level it.
Oh no, now you're committed.
I'm committed. But it's drke.co.
I like
it. And yeah, thanks for inviting me. It was great.
Thank you for joining, Matt. I appreciate it.
Strategy Inside Everything is produced by me, Adam Pierno. If you like what you've heard, leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Actually, I have no idea if that helps or if it's ever done anybody any good. If you really want to help the show and you like what you've heard, share it with someone else you think will dig it. That's the best way to help the show and keep the conversation growing. If you have an idea, a question, or want to push back, go to thatsnotaninsight.com, where you can send me a message or leave me a voicemail that will be added to future shows. Music for the Strategy Inside Everything is by Saw Square Noise. For more information on me, you can go to adampierno.com to learn about my books, my speaking, and my consulting practice. Thanks for listening.